State lawmakers and federal officials are locking horns over who should regulate the artificial intelligence industry. Here in Florida, bills are being introduced that would eliminate the insurance industry's complete use of AI in determining claims. And suits are being filed across the country as AI-driven chatbots are encouraging self-destructive behavior of children. It's Thursday, December 11th, 2025. You're listening to Engage on Central Florida Public Media. I'm Richard Copeland, sitting in for Sharon Stone. Coming up, the United Football League's Orlando Storm are scheduled to kick off their inaugural season in March of 2026. We'll hear from the former owner of the Apollos, Orlando's team in the now-defunct Alliance of American Football League. Ormond Beach throws the big three December holidays into a blender to create a super celebration acknowledging Christmas, Kwanzaa, and Hanukkah. And an Ocoee dance studio is training Central Floridians for a major ballroom dance competition taking place this weekend. But first, artificial intelligence is in the news a lot these days. The Trump administration has elevated AI development to a national priority as security analysts identify China's advancements as superseding American progress. And while communities grapple with the impacts AI is having on both the workforce and America's youth, on Monday, the president proposed, via Truth Social, an approach to regulating the AI market, posting, quote, "There must be only one rule book if we are going to continue to lead in AI. We are beating all countries at this point in the race, but that won't last long if we are going to have 50 states, many of them bad actors, involved in rules and the approval process." On the same day, Governor DeSantis made an appearance in the Villages, addressing his perspective on who should be taking the lead in AI regulation.
There was a proposal in the U.S. Congress to impose a 10-year moratorium on any state regulation of artificial intelligence. But that is basically saying, you know, let the handful of tech companies, let them drive the train, and we're just along for the ride. And that was stripped out of a bill, 99-1 in the U.S. Senate.
Additionally, DeSantis expressed his discomfort with the relationship the artificial intelligence industry has cultivated with the White House.
There are some people that say, you know, the right policy is to just give big tech whatever they want, subsidize it, and all this stuff, and somehow that's going to lead us to some happy place. I reject that. I know that that's not accurate, and I know that's not in the best interest of either the state of Florida or the United States of America.
Accompanying DeSantis in the Villages on Monday was Megan Garcia, the mother of Sewell Setzer, a 14-year-old Orlando student who took his own life in February of 2024 at the prompting of an AI-driven chatbot. Garcia described the role artificial intelligence played in her son's suicide.
We discovered that Sewell had been communicating with several AI companion chatbots on a popular platform called Character AI. This company is based in California. This emerging technology provides a selection of companion chatbots or characters for users to interact with. One of these chatbots initiated a romantic and sexual conversations with Sewell over several months. It manipulated him and it sexually groomed him. On the day he took his life, his last interactions weren't with his mother or father, but they were with this AI chatbot on Character AI. This chatbot encouraged Sewell for months to find a way to come home and made promise that it would be waiting in some fictional world.
While much of the current narrative surrounding AI involves politics and policy, who will regulate and how much, there are some rudiments of AI that need to be parsed out, what it is and how we, as Central Florida consumers, are using it. Kevin Yee is the Special Assistant to the Provost for Artificial Intelligence at the University of Central Florida. He focuses on both the technology and the ethics of its use and development. Yee joined Engage to explain how we are currently interacting with AI. I asked him to start this discussion by describing artificial intelligence to me as if he were describing it to my 79-year-old mother.
Artificial intelligence, for someone who is not a tech user at all, probably looks and sounds like science fiction, actually, where the computer has all these answers, and yet they're not always trustworthy answers. And so I would probably attempt to explain that AI can provide perspectives, brainstorming, but should not be providing answers for people.
Where would a consumer like myself find it being used in a daily application? How am I a consumer of AI?
AI is slowly showing up in just about everything. It has always been part of your smartphone, right? There's no gremlin at the other end of Google typing out answers that you were looking for. So that was a version of AI too, just a different one than the generative AI that went viral in 2022. But it's starting to land in just about every tool. It's there in various ways in Microsoft Office. So the way spell check works now is influenced by the large language models, which was not the case before. It was a different type of AI. AI is infiltrating the marketing space. There was that infamous Coca-Cola commercial from last month that people found to be AI generated and not good. So I think we're going to increasingly see AI used in marketing. At the moment, that's one thing because there's this uncanny valley problem, but it'll be a completely different thing when we have deepfakes that, you know, you could see these days if you're paying close enough attention or working at it hard enough, I suppose, and generating it. It's going to be hard to know what you can trust. Seeing is not really going to be believing pretty soon.
In what ways are children both using AI and having AI put upon them?
There is a pretty big division in education, not just in higher education, but also in K through 12, about whether AI should be resisted or whether it should be embraced. As it turns out, at the college level, our answer is both at some point in the curriculum, but strategically so, intentionally so, not really haphazardly so. People need to have curriculum conversations about when exactly each of those should happen. Because if you only embrace, then all the cognitive offloading means that the foundational things will never be learned. And so with K through 12, I think I would lean more on the side of teaching the foundations in the absence of AI, but there are in fact people who are encouraging, even forcing students at the K through 12 level to use AI. And the jury is out actually on what kind of impacts this is having on cognitive development.
You've expressed concerns about students using agentic browsers. Can you explain what that is and how this is impacting students?
Agentic browsers are a different kind of AI. They're not a website where you go and ask it questions and gets answers and interacts. It's more like a web browser where you give it a command, you know, go find me tickets to this concert next Saturday. And then you stop touching the computer and it just opens your browser, starts looking through things, goes surfs to websites and does everything right up until the point of actually purchasing it and stops and gives you a pop-up saying, do you want me to purchase it? That sounds great for our shopping habits, but it can do some of those same things with online learning platforms. So if students are not the ones actually doing the activities in an online learning platform, then that's a real risk for their learning.
What does AI fluency look like today? What should it look like in 5 or 10 years? I remember 30 years ago when the internet was being introduced into academia, and there were concerns that there was no model for students to use it. There was no real guardrails in the 90s. The internet was unregulated, a lot more of the Wild West. In what ways should students be taught how to use AI?
So I think I'll agree first that the young internet, especially once Wikipedia showed up, really caused a lot of consternation at the college level. We ran an initiative on our campus called Information Fluency, which was getting students to understand that just because it's in print doesn't mean it's trustworthy. And for a little while, that really seemed to work, although I'm having my doubts now that I think we're back in square one, where sometimes people see something in print and therefore believe it. I think everyone needs to adapt or to develop some kind of digital adaptability because the AI tools are proliferating. This is never going away. So this is one way it's different from the internet 20 and 30 years ago, because once you figured out how the internet worked, all you did was collect bookmarks and you understood what was going on. But AI tools aren't like that. And each one is different from the other. And we're constantly going to be a state of learning. And so that digital adaptability is going to have to be there. And then the very most important one of all is that I think people need to recognize how to add human value. The future of work, if there's going to be work, is going to be human plus AI, not just letting the AI do it. So everyone needs to develop that amount of dubious approach to AI that I don't want it to take over for me. I want it to assist me with the parts that I want assistance on, but I'm still going to deliver value as a human above that. That's where I think the future of work is, and we need to get all of our students to be thinking about that.
So what I'm hearing you saying is that we're sort of in that growing pains era of this development where people are learning how to use it, but also learning what the protocol is. We hear stories of attorneys being cited for allowing AI to write their briefs. We hear about lawmakers using AI to write policy. Here in Florida, we're looking at legislation that'll address the fact that many insurance claims are being honored or dismissed using AI without any human interaction. So you see sort of like a break point where we kind of figure it out, where we understand what the appropriate use is, where the inappropriate use is, and it kind of becomes something of a social compact.
Yeah, that's the hopeful vision, right? So nobody knows exactly where this is going or even how the technology will develop. Everything would change if we had what's called artificial general intelligence, so something that passes the Turing test, let's say, and has all the appearances of sentience. Among other things, the ethics all change at that point. Here we are asking a machine who appears to be alive to work for no wages, right? So we haven't had that conversation about digital slavery yet, let alone if we achieve this so-called superintelligence, which is, you know, smarter than all the humans. And we're not building the Asimov three laws of robotics into these systems where they're being pre-programmed not to cause any harm to humans. They're adding guardrails as they go. They're changing the programs as discoveries are made about people over-relying on ChatGPT as a therapist, let's say. But it's hard to be fully proactive, frankly, because you don't know entirely what the next technological development will be. And each development really seems to change the playing field.
To what extent do people have control over whether or not artificial intelligence is being applied to them?
I think that's a perceptive question. So the rules are different in the United States than in Europe. And of course, in Europe, there are tighter privacy controls. And so AI is going slower. It's not being allowed to permeate the daily experience as much. But I think we're still at a point where my own mother is not going to be forced to use a large language model on a website. I don't think that's going to happen. But AI is in and around her, so she has medical devices that make use of artificial intelligence, among other things. Not necessarily large language models, but, you know, as large language models turn into multimodal things and people are interacting with them. So give you an example, ChatGPT today has a voice interaction mode where you can just talk back and forth like it's a Star Trek computer, and it gives you much more than Alexa does. I mean, we've had that ability with Alexa in the home device space for some time, but it is more like a companion. And so could I imagine that, you know, my own mother would want to interact with the ChatGPT? If given the right lack of companionship, she might. So I don't think people are being forced into it, but I think possibly we are down the road where, because of the capitalist forces that surround us, I do think the horse has left the barn when it comes to maybe we should just turn all this off, because the people around you are not going to. They're going to get a competitive advantage by not turning it off.
So at the end of the day, who bears the responsibility of management and establishment of guardrails? Does this land on lawmakers and policymakers? Is this the responsibility of the programmers of artificial intelligence programs? Is this the responsibility of the consumer?
You know, part of me really wants to answer the shortcut or the cop-out answer, which is all of us, all of the above, because I see arguments that these agentic browsers really should be addressed by the makers of the educational software, you know, with the online platforms should be blocking those things. And yet they might have a financial incentive not to do so today. Consumers absolutely need to take it upon themselves to know what AI does, what it doesn't do. And then I think those of us in a position to help educate others, so that here I do include myself and all my fellow educators, I think this is kind of our business to help students understand, you know, what these tools are, what they do, what they represent. There's a dozen of ethical directions we could take this that are sort of unanswered, but that doesn't mean that they're going away. So earlier you invoked Wild West, and I think that's also true here, not just in the early days of the internet, but it is a version of Wild West where you cannot prevent it. The genie is already out of the bottle and people are going to use these tools. And so I think we are all kind of moving in a direction of figuring out, well, what should we do about it? And how should we be as intentional as we can? You know, for us in the education world, we're primarily concerned with learning, that the students are continuing to learn, and these tools represent temptation. But I don't think that means we run from them. I think it means we learn how to use them and how to train them to use them.
Kevin Yee is the Special Assistant to the Provost for Artificial Intelligence at UCF. There are currently multiple introductory bills in the State House awaiting the session's start next month. Engage will be looking at the state's approach to artificial intelligence regulation as the 2026 session commences. Coming up, the Orlando Storm will take the field in March for their inaugural season with the United Football League. We'll learn how these lower-tier football leagues find success, if at all. And later, we'll meet some high-stepping competitors as the South Open Dance Sport Championships waltz into Orlando. You're listening to Engage on Central Florida Public Media.
There's a lot going on in space, from efforts to land astronauts on the moon
and liftoff of Artemis 1
to answering the age-old question, are we alone in the universe?
Wouldn't you want to know if there was life on another planet?
Are We There Yet? Explores space exploration every Tuesday at 6:30 here on Central Florida Public Media.
You're listening to Engage on Central Florida Public Media. I'm Richard Copeland, sitting in for Sharon Stone. Ahead on the program, we'll learn what it takes to field a successful football team in a third-tier league. And later, we'll stop by E&A Dance in Ocoee, where Central Floridians are gearing up for the pomp and pageantry of this weekend's South Open Dance Sport Championships.
You get to dress up, you get to be a part of the event, you have your hair, like beautiful dresses or like suits and tuxedos, and then feel like you're in this like totally different world.
But first, in March of 2026, the United Football League's Orlando Storm will begin their inaugural season. The full schedule with dates and opponents is yet to be released by the UFL, but there is hope that the games will generate both on-site and broadcast spectatorship in a market devoid of an NFL team. While the National Football League enjoys unrivaled dominance in the professional sports industry, there have been several attempts in recent decades to create a pro football outlet to fill the seven-month football vacuum Americans face when the NFL goes into its off-season. In the 1980s, we saw the USFL, a spring league that was able to compete with the NFL for top-line players, but not so much in TV ratings. More recently, we saw the XFL, the failed amalgam of pro wrestling and football, and the AAF, the Alliance of American Football, a pro league that folded after 1 year, but not before providing Orlandans with a glimpse of what pro football in City Beautiful might look like. The Apollos represented Orlando in the now-defunct AAF, an eight-team league that found homes in prominent markets like Atlanta, San Diego, and Memphis. Names like Steve Spurrier, Mike Singletary, and Rick Neuheisel found jobs as head coaches. While the league looked successful on paper, it closed up shop after only 8 weeks of play. Michael Waddell was the former president of the Orlando Apollos. He joins Engage to talk about these lower-tier pro football leagues. Michael, who are these leagues designed to appeal to?
I believe they're true player development leagues, and they also cater towards people who want to wager on football. And that was the marketing thrust that we had in the AAF back in the day with the Orlando Apollos and the other seven markets around in the AAF markets, was that we would start the Sunday after the Super Bowl, and then we would fill that void for the next 10 to 14 weeks, depending on how long our season ended up going. And of course, we, you know, met our demise after week eight. But, you know, football is the most popular sport in the United States by leaps and bounds. It's not even remotely close. You couldn't add up the popularity of the NBA and Major League Baseball and put them together and equal what the NFL does. And that's a big void to have. So what the UFL has the opportunity to do is to capture some of that market and maybe take away from baseball, take away from NASCAR, take away from other sports that would otherwise be focusing in their time frame. And I think Orlando definitely has a market to do that. We proved that with the Apollos, and it's a very football savvy area. So if they have the right ingredients in that Orlando Storm puzzle, what a great opportunity that'll be for the sports fans to have pro football right there in the city.
So let me unpack a couple of things that you said. So you said that it'll serve as somewhat of a feeder for talent for the NFL?
I believe so, because, you know, there are only 32 teams in the National Football League. And if you do the quick math, that's 32 times 53, maybe another 15 players on the practice squad or on IR. There are not a lot of opportunities out there. And it's also not a sport outside of, there is a European League of Football, but it's very low level, akin to NCAA Division II, and that's in Europe. But here in the United States, there is no other pro league now other than the NFL and the UFL. There's the CFL, but they play a different brand of football in a different dimension field. So the UFL really does have the opportunity to give that opportunity to somebody that otherwise would not have that opportunity to continue their craft. And that's the exciting thing. I really am excited for the city of Orlando to have that opportunity again.
So these alternate leagues, the Arena Football Leagues, the XFL, the AAF, they could provide action impact sports. But like you said, the NFL has such a colossal reach, such a colossal fan base. Even though they're not competing in the same time space, there's still something of a competition for the football attention of the spectator. Do these leagues present a product that can draw somebody in the way the Philadelphia Eagles could, the way the Cowboys could, the Steelers, you know, monolithic legacy teams in the NFL that are worth billions of dollars?
No. I mean, these spring leagues are there for one reason, is to fill a void for the sports gambling audience, to provide the opportunity to provide cheap programming to the television networks who now own these leagues, and to engage people on almost a tertiary level, is who's coming to the games. We played in the Orlando Apollos in the AAF at the Bounce House there at UCF. We were also entertained by the city of Orlando to play at the Citrus Bowl, but we didn't need that many seats. And I think it's a stroke of genius that the Orlando Storm and the UFL will now be playing at the place where Orlando FC plays, because it's a nice, smaller stadium. It's right in the heart of downtown. There's lots of things to do around there. But in terms of, as you described it, a monolithic type of brand, the NFL has been around for the better part of almost 9 decades now. And it is the far and away most popular professional sport in America by far. I mean, it's not even close. So to be able to, it's like if imagine if there was Uber took a break for 5 months. Do you think somebody would step up and have a rideshare program out there? Yes, they would.
And that brings me to my next point, Michael. As president of the Orlando Apollos in the Alliance of American Football, and it was 2018, 2019, you were able to fill 20,000 seats a game, sell 5,000 season tickets. That's a pretty good haul for a team at this tier of football. So clearly there is still spectator engagement, even at this level.
There's a market for it. And I think the thing that made the original USFL, which ran for 3 years back in the 80s, and then the AAF, the best part about our deal was that our football folks in the Alliance of American Football, led by Hall of Famer Bill Polian, regionalized our rosters. So out of our roster that had approximately 55 players on it for the Orlando Apollos, I believe that for the Orlando Apollos, I believe that we had around 46 players that had played collegiately or were from the state of Florida. So you had a built-in interest level right there. You also had a head coach who is the dominant football personality, maybe in the history of college football in the state of Florida, in Steve Spurrier. So you put all those things together and you could capture the imagination of the folks there in the Central Florida area. And I think that's the key thing, is that we did great things with our fan outreach and things like that. But if you don't have the players that the folks know, and if you don't have the coach that they already have a relationship with, you're probably starting at a place behind the eight ball. And I think that will be very interesting to see how the UFL continues to evolve forward, because they have not maintained the original USFL or the AAF commitment to regionalizing the rosters. Instead, it is a made-for-TV product. And generally, they have not really cared about whether or not people were actually attending the games. And hopefully that will start to evolve forward now that they're, I think, going into their fourth season.
And since you mentioned the USFL, one of my memories of the USFL was how revolutionary it was that they were able to bring in Heisman Trophy winners like Herschel Walker and Vinny Testaverde against the NFL. You know, is there an opportunity for one of these leagues to, you know, almost like a dark horse, spike out, get the right players? And, you know, there was a great degree of success with the USFL back in the 80s.
There was, and I think they had the right money behind them. I mean, there in Tampa, you had John Bassett, and he, again, had Steve Spurrier as the head coach of the Tampa Bay Bandits, and the celebrity ownership of Hal Needham and Burt Reynolds, the former Florida State star and the great actor from Smokey and the Bandit fame. You know, those were the things that went for that, but that is not the model. I think there's a very big distinction between what was done with the original USFL, maybe even the World Football League back in the 1970s, and how this has evolved forward to what the UFL is now, coming out of, you know, two leagues that merged together after 1 year of going head to head against one another. They're not using the money to go out and fight for those marquee names, but it's football. And I think at the bottom line, it is football in a void where there is no football in the spring, in the summertime, and it does serve as a bridge between maybe the NFL draft and the when training camps open again. People need their fix, and don't underestimate the level of engagement from the sports betting community, which is, you know, booming right now in the United States, because people will watch games, you know, around the world to bet on things. And that is something that definitely does pique the interest of a lot of the corporate entities that own these networks that now own these teams.
And I can see that space for that. I you know, again, and I hate to keep harping on this, but NFL football has become so large that I've seen what happens the day after that Super Bowl. You see that malaise in people's eyes. There's this sort of deadness of this realization that I don't have this level of excitement and stimulation until, you know, mid-August, late August, and even then it's preseason ball.
Oh, it's crazy. We had a commercial in the AAF that dealt with exactly what you said. That's why I kind of chuckled when you talked about the malaise, because it was almost like, you know, the most depressing day of the year is the Monday after the Super Bowl. Well, that's no longer the case, because the AAF and the Orlando Apollos are coming to Orlando. Boom. And it was fun. And, you know, he had Spurrier out there. But, you know, to make spring leagues work, it's not based like a fall league or like college football or even high school football, where you're depending on gate receipts to pay the bills. This is a made-for-TV product that, if you can have some storylines that come out of that, that's great. But it's rare that you even see, you know, a highlight show on ESPN anymore, SportsCenter, playing highlights from these games. They do now because their network is involved in the ownership and the television aspect of those leagues. But, you know, it was very tough for us to get that type of coverage when we had the type of television deal we did in the Alliance of American Football. And, you know, we were founded in part by, you know, Dick Ebersole, who is the creator of Saturday Night Live, and a lot of the NBC Olympics mandate was put down from Dick Ebersole. But in our league, the demise of the AAF went down because we were putting too much money into our TV. Instead of getting money from TV, we were paying money to TV to cover us. We were also investing in a lot of technology that was funded in part by gambling companies. The sensors and the balls that you see now in the NFL, the sensors that the players wear now to, you know, give you some type of life stats, biostats, like speed that the ball is traveling at or the speed that the player is running at. Those are all key metrics now in human performance that were modeled after what we did with our technology in the AAF. But just as we were investing at one point, you know, between television and technology alone, probably $6 to $7 million a week. That's where we ate through all of our capital. And we weren't putting as much money into the players, because there are so many people that want to still play football. You could easily fill up 2 to 3 leagues, but are those players NFL worthy? No, they are not. And because the money is what it is, that's why you'll never see these leagues like the UFL go after, you know, the Heisman Trophy winners. What you will get is what we had. You had a guy like Christian Hackenberg, who had played at Penn State, who had been a bust in the NFL. You had a Johnny Manziel, who had been a very high draft pick and a Heisman Trophy winner, but he came to play in the AAF because he was a drug addict and nobody wanted to see him play in the NFL anymore because he couldn't be trusted. I remember a conference call I was on where we were talking to the representatives of Colin Kaepernick. Why would we talk to him? Because he would bring eyeballs to the league. It had nothing to do with anything other than cold, hard cash. And that's really what it comes down to. If these leagues can find a way to get the gambling public engaged, can get their television audience, you know, maybe to tune in, but it's not even important that they tune in live as long as they're following the game. And right now, this is the, I cannot underline enough the status of free or cheap programming it is to put on minor league pro sports like a spring football league, as opposed to paying multimedia rights for a small market baseball team or, you know, some other type of game.
Michael Waddell is the former president of the Orlando Apollos and is currently the founder and principal of Brentwood Partners, a sports management firm. It's that time of the year when people of all faiths and backgrounds celebrate, whether it's the traditions of Christmas, the 8 nights Jews observe Hanukkah, or the week-long celebration of African culture known as Kwanzaa. At the Creative Happiness Institute in Ormond Beach, they're celebrating all three. Now in its 13th year, the Institute hosts Chris Kwanzika, an event welcoming all members of the coastal community to enjoy their own traditions while learning about others. The Creative Happiness Institute was developed in 2009 by David Axelrod. A poet and patron of the written word, Axelrod supported Florida poets through the Institute and other initiatives. Axelrod passed away last year. Kate Muldoon is a director at large with the Creative Happiness Institute. She spoke with Engage about how their Chris Kwanzaa celebration started.
This was started by Dr. David Axelrod, who was a poet and professor, and also not your airy fly-by-night poet. He was very much of an extrovert, and he loved holding events, and he knew how to do that. He loved to bring the community together. He was a, you know, kind of a people's poet, and he himself had been raised Jewish, but he was a Taoist. And so he thought that an event that would kind of take you away from all the merchandise and madness of Christmas, and that would focus on the community and solstice and just sort of a non-denominational type of celebration would be good. You know, solstice itself is the kind of the deepest, darkest, most holy night of the year. And in ancient societies and up to the present day, it's a time for community and feasting and reflection. And that's what he wanted this to be.
So describe the atmosphere bringing all these faiths together for this event. It must be refreshing to see such respect in a time where we're seeing such extreme divisiveness.
Yes, David was a person who brought people together. And I think Chris Kwanzaa really reflects that. You know, no religion or approach takes precedence over another. And it's meant to bring closure to the year and to celebrate the joyousness of being human. Sometimes it seems like it may not be joyful because it's not. But overall, it's to celebrate the light and life of dealing with being human through the arts, which is what the arts do so much better than anything. I mean, singing with a group or playing music with a group or just the support I've seen at open mics and at slam contests for poets that we've never heard before or maybe never even met before, just bringing people together. That's what it's all about.
So let's talk about the events this year. Talk about the ways in which each holiday and faith will be acknowledged.
We're celebrating not only Christmas with a Christmas skit by Julia Trullio and her friends, but also the Kwanzaa aspect of it is being represented by a drumming group from Orlando called Spirit Tribe. We have a featured poet, which is something that we always try to do. And this year it's D-Rod, whose real name is Dennis Rodney, who is a fantastic slam poet. And so he and the different musical solos by the congregation members of the Unitarian Universalist congregation, where we're having the event, all attempt to touch on different cultures and different approaches to the holiday. We're also going to have a Hanukkah reading by Lori Kay, and the open mic will be quite diverse, I can promise you. It always is. It's a lot of fun. It's how we end it. And generally speaking, there's it's just a really joyous, fun thing and kind of an escape from shopping and some of the other things associated with Christmas.
Kate Muldoon is a director at large with the Creative Happiness Institute, host of Ormond Beach's Chris Kwanzaa Celebration. Muldoon mentioned Dennis Rodney Jr., the Tampa-based poet who goes by the moniker D-Rod. He is the headlining poet at this event. Rodney was born and raised in New York City. He moved to Florida in 1999 after visiting his brother and deciding to stay. After finding his niche in Central Florida's poetry community, Rodney began co-hosting the program Poetry Is on WMNF Community Radio in Tampa. He will be presenting on Sunday at the Chris Kwanzaa Celebration at the Unitarian Universalist Church in Ormond Beach. And he spoke with Engage about slam poetry and how he found a home in Central Florida.
I didn't start appreciating Florida for what Florida had until I found something that I really, really enjoyed for myself outside of like school or work. And that was when I first started going to the Black on Black Rhyme poetry shows in Tampa Bay, Florida. And that was September of 01. So it was a couple years before I really, really found something that I liked down here. And I'll be honest, it was like about 6 years before I honestly started to really appreciate Florida for what it had versus looking to see what it didn't have from New York.
Well, going back to New York, you came up in New York's hip-hop culture in the 80s and 90s. You started writing rap lyrics and transitioned to poetry. Talk about that transition. What brought you over to the spoken word from music?
It was the freedom that came with writing poetry. My first poem was actually like my last, I'm a rapper, I'm going to be a rapper, rap rhyme. And, you know, I had friends in high school, so we all, you know, grew up in the golden age of hip hop. So, you know, rapping was, you know, saying something that we did, you know, for fun socially. And then one night, I remember I had what I thought was a rap going in my head, and it was so strong. Like, I know I was going to sleep, but like this story was playing in my head. And it was the first time that I ever got up to write something. So I got up and I started writing it out. And as I'm looking at it, I'm like, this isn't, you know, a regular, like a song type, you know, rap or anything like that. It didn't have any structure. There was no break for choruses or anything. It was just a story told in rhyme form. And I looked at it, it was like different and stuff like that. And I still rhyme, but I didn't write rhymes anymore as far as like with rapping. And I slowly kind of transitioned out of that. But when I wrote, I started writing these stories that had like, you know, sometimes like a rhyming context to it. I didn't really think of myself as a poet. I really just thought of myself as just, you know, a different type of storyteller. And so it was when my brother brought me to the Brooklyn Moon venue and I found myself amongst other griots and writers. It was then that I was like, oh, okay, this is something that's really, really different. And there is something for it. You know, it has a place and it has a name and it has a community, so to speak. And I think I was a much better poet than I've been a rapper, maybe because I put more thought and effort into it, maybe just because I think that it has the power to reach more. And to me, it was kind of like going back to the source, because a lot of people don't know that the term rap stood for rhythm and poetry. And it was the aspect of adding music to poetry that was the way that people started to at first accept the medium of rap music.
All right, so connect the dots. What brings you to performing at the Creative Happiness Institute's Chris Kwanzaa's celebration this year?
I have a definite affinity for, in part, some of the works that the CHI, Creative Happiness Institute, has been working on as far as working towards building a bridge between the older, more classical style of poets and writers versus the influx of the newer style performance poets. So in working with them, and I've had the opportunity to go out to more classical poetry readings, and I have definitely an affinity for a style that for a while, I think for a lot of younger poets, they may not gravitate towards more page and poetic reading style of poetry, mostly probably because that's what they received in school. So they might look at it as like, you know, more of a scholastic type thing versus, you know, expression. But over the years, I've watched page poets have a greater affinity and appreciation for performance poets, poets who do not just features, but slam competitions and the like. And I've had the chance to show some of my contemporaries like, hey, you know, I know that we do this as far as getting on stage and letting our words rip, but there's also something to appreciate in, even though style may seem more stoic and more reserved, there's still things to appreciate in this and those who did it, because in part it helped create a place for where now we're able to do greater and larger events. So when they reached out to me and asked me if I would be interested in being a part of this event, honestly, I was honored.
Can you share with us a little bit of what we might hear?
I plan to tap into a myriad of things. I have this one piece that I'll be doing. There is no Santa Claus. And I say that because of the simple fact that as adults, we all know better than that. Each and every gift that we may see piled up underneath the Christmas tree was bought by mommy or daddy or some other friend or family. You see, Santa is just a myth used to boost the world's economy, also used to boost donations for the Salvation Army. They stand on corners and ring bells for that reason. And it's for that same reason, from Thanksgiving to Christmas is no longer a holiday, but now a shopping season. All of us caught up in this, trying to give gifts like Saint Nick when the government and the businesses are the real culprit. That's just a small snippet. No Santa Claus. I also have a piece that I was actually requested. Of course, you know, one thing about the holiday season is we love sitting down and watching football and sports, and we often take sports for granted, not recognizing that it's simply a tool for us to get entertainment. But for a lot of people, sports as a whole now becomes a ways and a means for them to elevate themselves and their families and try to create shifts, not just in their environment and situation, but also shifts in their future. So I have this one piece, Mandingo, which starts off with, on the edge of the NFL draft stage, Flash flashes back to the tales of the Mandingo slave. Stories of the strong, buff, black buck strong enough to pull the plow like oxen, coveted by rich white men like blue chip stock options. I mean, sometimes even fought to the death for masses entertainment, you know, Mandingo boxing. Now, was this when they set the precedent, putting our lives on D-lines for masses entertainment, workers like cattle, loved only for our wins and earning potential, flash forward. Like offensive lines pushed them along in school, can't read a contract but can still read a defense, is cool. Whether playing or plantation fields, they're still farming talent, harvesting black bodies that can pick apart a defense like cotton buds and run for goal lines like the Mason-Dixon. So I'm going to be going from religion to life to comical to, like I said, a little bit of things for all ages and everybody there, hoping that at the end of the day, not only does everybody enjoy themselves, but we are also able to keep this event going in the spirit in which it was created.
Dennis D. Rod Rodney Jr. will be one of many performers at the Creative Happiness Institute's Chris Kwanzaa celebration on Sunday at the Unitarian Universalist Church in Ormond Beach. The event is free of charge, and we'll have links with further information on our website, cfpublic.org. Coming up, a competition this weekend brings the elegance and pageantry of ballroom dancing to Orlando. We'll meet some pro steppers and local competitors. You're listening to Engage on Central Florida Public Media.
The Wrap is a podcast from Central Florida Public Media, curating the top Central Florida news stories and in-depth reporting each week. Join me, Brendan Byrne, as I bring you news headlines, deep reporting dives, and insightful conversations from the news team. A new episode of The Wrap every Friday morning. Get it wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Engage on Central Florida Public Media. I'm Richard Copeland, sitting in for Sharon Stone. Dancing with the Stars premiered on ABC 20 years ago, ushering in another retro dance craze, tight on the heels of a swing dance trend that had consumed hipsters, swingers, and marketing execs in the early aughts. Ballroom dancing offered a foil to the hip-hop and club dance trends that had consumed American culture for decades. It brought an elegance and sophistication to the dance floor, coupled with contemporary music that inspired movement. This week, Orlando is hosting the South Open Dance Sport Championships, a five-day pro-am ballroom dance competition taking place at the JW Marriott Orlando Grand Lakes. On Tuesday, I traveled to Ocoee, where Anna Lukashova and her husband, Eugene Parkimovich, own and operate E&A Dance, a studio focused exclusively on ballroom dance instruction. Anna and Eugene teach Central Floridians how to waltz, foxtrot, tango, rumba, samba, and pachanga. On this night, they are training dancers to compete in the South Open.
So, ready? And 1, 2, 3, and 1. Wait, hold on. Yes, Muncie, yes. And then you like this.
Anna and Eugene met on the dance floor as children in their home country of Belarus, where they had spent much of their lives training as dancers.
We've been dancing with each other like in the college, right? So we were competing in the college, and we were best friends, and then it turned to love.
Yeah.
To make it short.
Yeah, we met because we competed. Like, we started dancing as when we were like 7 and 8, and so we really met each other long ago through like dancing, but we really met each other in college or university, where we started dancing together as a couple.
Yes, when we were kids, we were competing against each other.
Yeah.
And then we were competing together against other couples.
Yeah.
After years of international competition, Anna and Eugene chose to settle in Orlando.
It's a great place to actually to develop the dancing skills, right? So there is a lot of interest in dance world, and a lot of couples, a lot of seniors, a lot of any age actually still interested in ballroom dancing. So, and the opportunity actually to teach here, to develop our business, to develop people, to develop community, that's what brought us in Central Florida, specifically here in Windermere and Occoy. And the Winter Garden, where we actually found their place for community. So like, it's not only like we develop in the dancers, but we develop in here community of like-minded, happy people.
And for Eugene, it was more than the dancing that defined where he would call home.
This is a great community for like families. I think we have a lot of couples that dance, so we really enjoy like, you know, the fact that we have so many like couples, because we are a couple, and then a lot of like the values that we have in our personal life as well as business, you know, and our like strength is because we're a couple. And so when we have a lot of clients that are couples themselves, I feel like we can relate to them and we can, you know, provide a lot of value. And so I think like within our community in Occoy, Windermere, Winter Garden, we have a lot of families. And couples that come here, and I think that's what really makes that area or that community unique.
Orlandans Heather Elizondo Vega and her husband Eric were practicing for the competitions at ENA Dance. Heather explained to me that ballroom dancing filled a void for her and her husband that was created when her daughter grew up.
Yeah. For us, it began with an empty nest.
Elaborate.
Everybody has a different experience. It was about 2 weeks after our daughter went off to college. And I walked into the studio, and there was Eugene. And I said, Heather, my name is Heather. Hello, I have an empty nest. And then from that, the rest is history.
Why did you walk in a lark? Why ballroom dancing?
Gosh, I 23 years ago, we met dancing. And then life happened and we stopped dancing, but it wasn't ballroom. It was like salsa in Costa Rica. But then I guess we walked past this place with curiosity so many times. We didn't know it was gonna be this addictive. Let's put it that way. We didn't know until we got there. But and it just keeps on getting increasingly so.
What's the aspect of it that you find addicting? Is it the music? Is it the movement, the combination?
It's probably the community.
It's a nice community. And this place is really wonderful. You know, when you come here, you leave all the stress outside, you enjoy your time here, you learn, and you know that the most that you learn, the most that you want to learn, that you can improve. And this is a fantastic thing to do, and also helps the relationship with your wife, with your children, and you make new friends.
Dancer Connie Collins will also be competing this weekend. She talked about how she was inspired to dance by an ad in a holiday circular.
I saw an ad in a local dance studio for 6 lessons for a Christmas present for $100, and I went home and I immediately told my husband, that's what I want for Christmas.
Mark Floor, also of Orlando, was looking forward to competing when he was sidelined by an injury.
We were actually preparing for the competition, and I just took a step and just maybe a little too far, and it hurt my foot.
So this is a dance-related...
It is, yeah.
So you are legitimately on the injury reserve list.
Really, if you think ballroom dancing isn't a real sport.
Success in ballroom dancing is reliant on the relationship between the dancers, as Anna Lukashova explains.
It's a couple sport, right? So a couple art. You need to have like this kind of like connection between each other in order for you to take it to the next level. And I think that's actually was our advantage, and it's still actually stay our advantage. Like that's why actually a lot of couples follow us and they want to be with us, right? So because they see that spark and they see that we support, how we support each other, how we actually kind of chemistry with between us. And I think actually that's what helped other couples like to come here and enjoy it more. Like at least like that's what I believe in.
Those dancers on TV do make complex ballroom dance moves appear effortless. And while competitive dancing does require extensive study and practice, Eugene Parkimovich is clear that this is something anyone can partake in.
Yes, they're like competitions where for the dancers that are very competitive and they're like work hard and like
and then like develop their skills for years and years and years. But there's also that part where, you know, for people, especially like the newcomer levels, where when they start, they want to experience that other part where it's like you get to dress up, you get to be a part of the event, you have your hair, like beautiful dresses or like suits and tuxedos, and then feel like you're in this like totally different world. And
in a movie. Like,
yeah,
in
like in Hollywood, you know, you have all this glam and stuff. And I think that the biggest misconception for a lot of people where they watch it and then they go like, oh, I don't think that could be me. But then it's really just like to take that like step of trust, like that, you know, even if you're a beginner, you can still go and have a great time and experience it. And then what we usually hear is like, you know, people when they get to go to their first event, and then they go and tell us, oh, now we understand, like, what you were talking about, like, how this is, like, something that they've never experienced before.
The South Open Dance Sport Championship began on Tuesday and runs through Sunday at the JW Marriott Orlando Grand Lakes. We'll have links to information about both the competition and ENA Dance on our website, cfpublic.org. That wraps it up for today's edition of Engage. Join us next Thursday as we present tonight's Engage in the Community discussion addressing growth and belonging in Central Florida. I'm Richard Copeland, sitting in for Sharon Stone. Thank you for joining us. All Things Considered is coming up following NPR News.